Welcome to the Better Clinician Podcast with myself, Ben Cormack, and also Adam Meekins. The Better Clinician Project brings you high-quality education at a ridiculously low price. This podcast will bring you topics that are relevant to modern clinical practice, all done with a bit of fun and humour. Nothing in this podcast constitutes medical advice. So, BCPers, we are back in the month of March for another thoughtful Thursday where we get down and dirty with the questions from our wonderful BCP members who are the lifeblood of our throbbing community.
There's some good descriptive words there. Throbbing, lifeblood. I'm wondering where you're going with this one.
I just wanted to capture the beating heart of the BCP community.
Ah, it's about the pulse. It's the that sort of throbbing. Okay, nothing. It's where my mind obviously is a little bit corrupt.
It is. Your mind is a disgusting cesspool of detritus and other bad stuff.
Yes, just filth. March madness. All right, let's go for it. So again, some great questions that have been fired at us, mate. Which one should we start off with? What do you fancy the look of?
Yeah, I think the juiciest one here has got to be from Daniel Dempsey. Nice, easy name to get right, I hope.
Thanks,
I hope
Daniel.
You got it right. Yeah, thanks, Daniel, for being a Daniel. So obviously we have a wide variety of diversity of names and nationalities on the BCP, which adds to the veritable smorgasbord of interaction that we have, but Daniel's kept it nice and easy for us.
Just makes it fucking hard for us to try and pronounce people's names.
Yeah. Well, we are particularly simple, aren't we? And common chaps.
Yeah. I struggle with English names, let alone ones that have got more than two syllables in them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I struggle with most English words as well, let alone when people, the English are particularly bad at foreign languages, aren't they?
I was having this discussion when I was in Holland, actually. I was saying to them, you know, I'm amazed at how good everybody's English was. Yeah. And, you know, I am impressed when I do travel around Europe, how everybody just, you know, does speak English really well as a default. And then it does make us rather ignorant and I feel embarrassed just walking into a place in a foreign country and just going, can I have a table for one, please?
Yes. And they, excuse me, garçon. And the thing is that they understand you perfectly, don't they?
They do. They are. Here we go. Another English guy. Yes, so, sir. Come on over.
I actually blame the world for enabling us to be so stupid when it comes to languages. If they made us muddle through, then maybe we'd be forced to up our game. But no one does. They enable us.
It's not our fault. It's your fault. Yeah.
Exactly. Passing blame has been an expert. Something I've become an expert in. Right. So what was Daniel's question there? If you've got it up in front of us.
I have. So Daniel is asking us a rather long and protracted question, but the crux of it is, and I think this is something that all good healthcare clinicians go through, is the Dunning-Kruger effect, you know, where you start off keen and eager and full of all the energy and enthusiasm and thinking you've got all the answers in all the world. And then that very quickly gets beaten out of you after a few months of clinical practice. And then you go into this very deep valley of despair and disillusionment, which can be quite hard to climb out of. And he's asking us, how can we do this? How can we climb out of the valley of despair? And also, you know, how can we talk to patients about, you know, the problems that they are finding as clinicians, where the evidence is saying, you know, all treatment seems to help people, but it also hasn't got any strong evidence to say it's really effective. So how can we put this across to patients? How can we navigate this disillusionment, this uncertainty as a clinician, trying to help people who come to see us for pain and they say, what should I do about it? So any thoughts on that, Ben?
Well, yeah, look, I mean, I don't know if I ever particularly discuss research with patients. I don't know if you, I don't ever go, oh my God, the meta-analysis by Barker et al. In 2023 and BJSM pointed towards. You know, I will, you know, people come to see you for your opinion, and you, I will say, in my opinion, I think this is the best option for us, you know, and pretty much let's give it a go and see what happens. And we might have to play with it and adjust it to make it fit better. So, you know, I think one of the problems is that, you know, I think the crux of it is, if I'm being really honest, do patients really care about evidence and research to some degree?
No, I think you make a good point, mate. And, I'm also, you know, very rarely talking about research or meta-analysis with patients. I may bring it up every now and again, depending on the questions that are being asked. But it is a tricky area to try and help patients navigate about what treatment options to go for or suggest, particularly when we say we haven't got much evidence to say one is more superior than the other. I like a little saying that I sometimes like to throw at people is saying, you know, when it comes to physiotherapy treatment, everything can work, but really we haven't got much evidence to say that anything works. So it's a bit of trial and error. It's a bit of, you know, basically trying to guide patients through what might be worth more their time, energy and effort to start off one, but then seeing how it does or doesn't affect them. And I think, you know, it's also that, you know, shared decision-making process, which is part of being an evidence-based clinician. It's getting the patient's ideas and preferences about what they would like to do. Obviously, you know, there's lines here to not cross. You know, we're not going to start going into the realms of quackery and woo and saying anything goes, because that's not what evidence-based practice suggests. But there is a lot of things for us to consider, you know, and so it's about explaining that to the patients openly and honestly, maybe discussing, you know, risks, rewards, pros and cons, benefits, alternatives, if you've got the time to do that, and say helping patients make an informed choice, which isn't always easy to do because we're all time pressured clinicians and it can be quite a time consuming process to do all that.
I had I go back to someone I saw last week, actually, last Wednesday. I thought it was a bit of a facet irritation, if I'm being honest, from the kind of...
That's specific, eh?
I know.
Did he have pain on extension?
Well, no, I said, when do you get your pain? I did a bit of... I actually used the boxing club for the first time in ages for a consult. I had him on the bed and prodding around and pressing around, couldn't find anything. So he then stood up and I said, well, when does it hurt? And he got himself into a position that looked just like you would if you were going to do something like a Kemp's test, which was quite interesting. So the reason why I bring that up is because I think sometimes we need to talk in probabilities, not certainties. Yes. So what I said to him was, oh, you know, what I reckon is you may have just irritated one of the joints in your back. From the movements you're doing, that might show us that you've irritated a joint in your back slightly. And I said to him, I reckon a little bit of movement in that area is probably going to help. Let's try two or three little movements and see which one you like the most or feels the best. And in that sense, you know, it's not saying exercise by Johnny et al. In 2017 is shown to have 2.3 VAS on a, you know, on a 100-point scale, and this is the with a confidence interval of 11.7, right? The point much more is, you know, this is what I think. This is what I think might help. Let's try a few different options and see how we get on. If it makes it feel worse, we're going to have an adjustment. If it makes it feel better, brilliant. Let's carry on with that.
Yeah, that's a good point there, mate. Particularly that point about, you know, giving a diagnosis in areas where we haven't got much certainty. And I think this is sometimes a misunderstanding of the term non-specific pain. A lot of people think that when we are talking about non-specific pain, it means that we've got absolutely no ideas or no certainties or no feelings of what it may be more than it may not be. So yeah. I often say this with the shoulder pain, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty in being specific about subacromial shoulder pain. A lot of structures can present very similarly there. But there are people that you assess and you'll say, I've got a suspicion that it's more likely to be the supraspinatus tendon than it is likely to be your long-header biceps tendon. And that's what clinical reasoning is. All the term non-specific means is we can't be that certain. We can't be that clear in explaining that it definitely is that. So I think that's a great point to say. Yeah, mate.
I might say, look, there's a few different things in there. You could have a bursa, you could have a tendon, you could even irritate the nerve, for example. We don't know exactly. And, you know, all of these things could be plausible. Nice thing is we can do a few exercises or whatever treatment you want, essentially. And we can see if that helps you, then that's brilliant. We can carry on with that. If it doesn't have the desired result, then we can do something else. And if you actually go to your doctor, that's pretty much the way that they talk. You know, they might say, look, go and see a physio. And, a consultant even might say, well, let's try this, then try this. And ultimately, at the end, you might have to have surgery. Well, that's not a very specific process, is it?
No, not
right? You know, and that happens every day. So I think that we just need to get used to talking in probabilities and likelihoods and alternatives and options, not in this is the diagnosis and this is the answer.
Yeah. I think if, you know, you have that approach where you are a little bit more flexible and adaptable and, you know, talking in probabilities rather than certainties, it means you're less likely to end up with egg on your face and look like a total wazzock as well. Because, you know, if it doesn't go according to plan and you've said it is this and it is going to do this and it doesn't, you know, you're not going to lose face or faith with the patient. They're going to be much more open and willing to try other things, and they probably will then, you know, be a bit more receptive. So I think, yeah, keeping that open-mindedness about what to do with somebody based on their responses and their passage of time is really important to do for clinicians.
So it's process over prescription, and that's something when I teach that, you know, I'm quite big on. But we even do this with antibiotics, don't we? So someone will go and have an antibiotic, and then the doctor will say, do you know what, that's not working the way we want it to work. Let's try another one. You know, because there might be antibiotics that are more generalized, like, you know, penicillin based ones, and there's ones that are more suited to the respiratory system, et cetera, et cetera. So the big thing here is, you know, let's start with this. Let's start with this dosage. If we need to change the drug or change the dosage or change the exercise and change the dosage, then let's do that. And I think what we're looking for is this cause and effect and linearity. You know, and I don't know who needs that. I think it's a clinician thing more than
anything. That's exactly what I was about to say. I think it's more for the benefit of the clinician than the patient. I think it just allows the clinician to, you know, deal with this uncertainty better in their own minds. It gives them this illusion of control, I think, you know, rather than having the flexibility and the adaptability. It takes that away and makes them, say, seem a bit more certain and skilled and specific and specialised, which...
You know who I actually blame? I actually think I blame the education system. And
not I do as well, yeah.
I think I blame continuing education. Do you know that? Because I think continuing education has always been about, you know, this is the master clinician, this is the way that he does things, this is the problem, this is the solution.
Yeah.
And everyone gets better.
And it is the protocol.
Exactly. It's easy to package and it's easy to sell.
If you
look at the world of medicine, you actually find that it's much more flexible. It's much more open to, you know, who did I speak to? I won't name names, but I was speaking with a doctor, and I'll tell you offline and you'll know the person. And they said to me, I deal all the time with non-specific stomach pain and non-specific chest pains. And they come into ER and they've got all these pains, and actually they leave ER feeling better, and we never knew what the problem was.
Yeah, no, I think it's a very hard pill to swallow. In fact, I did a meme on this a couple of months ago, you know, that hard to swallow pill memes. You see the picture of the pills that says hard to swallow, and underneath it I had the little caption, not all pain has a diagnosis, and that be it, headaches and stomach pains and elbow pains, knee pains, back pains. We can't always know where the pain comes from, because it can come and it can disappear just as quickly without any rhyme or reason.
Yeah. Tell me where headaches come from.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so, BCPers can go and check out the headache section that we did, because we tried to get some answers for that, but there is some uncertainty there, that's for sure.
Loads of uncertainty, stomach aches, headaches, all of these
things. But humans just don't deal with uncertainty very well. No matter how I talk about it and I try to help clinicians through it, I still don't like being uncertain. No human being does. It's an innate human trait. We like to make sense of the world. We like to have things nice and organized and packaged. I'd say you're probably a little bit better at it, because I can tell that you don't like things as organized. You're quite happy to live in a bit of a chaotic mess. And I've just seen your laptop desktop that always reminds me about how your brain functions. So I think you are quite happy to have.
I live in that gray world of
chaos and yeah.
But I did that, didn't I? After one of our discussions, I did an Insta poll. And for a little bit, it was a little bit, it was going your way. And then it swung back round. And I think it was about 55% like to think they're neat. And then about 45% are a bit more chaotic like me. So yeah. At one point, it was like 70-30. And I was like, damn this. This is going to show me up to be a bad human. But then we swung back round and we got on to a bit of an even keel there. But going back to Daniel, I think basically, you know, it's not that we don't have answers, it's that we don't have certainty. And I think there's a real big difference between having lots of ideas and lots of opinions and theories, and some backed by data and some backed by a little bit of experience, and you know, some backed by some decent clinical reasoning. It's just not being wed to any single one of them too much and being willing to adapt and adjust. And this is what I think, this is what we're going to try. If it doesn't work, we're going to do something else.
Absolutely. Trial and error. And keep the faith.
But it is informed trial and error. It's not random. And I think that's really important to point out.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for the question, Daniel. Hope that's in a roundabout way giving you some ideas and solutions, perhaps. But then again, maybe not. Maybe we just add to more uncertainty and confusion.
Yeah. We've just added to your confusion. Soz, LOL, soz.
Right, let's get on to the next question from the BCP, and this is a return appearance. This is by Michal, who I abused his name really badly last time. And Michal has asked us quite an interesting and intriguing and quite a humorous question, I think. What is the line that...
Made me laugh.
Yeah. So the question that Michal asks is, what is the line that you won't cross when it comes to developing a relationship with the patient?
Well, I think I'm going to move away from this question and leave this one to Adam Meekins. You can go first, buddy.
Yeah, I could probably get myself in hot water if this one. I think it's actually quite an intriguing question. We know patient relationship, therapist patient relationship is fundamental. It's key. You know, I talk about this a lot when I teach. I say, if you want to get a good result with a patient, get the patient to like you, get the patient to trust and respect you.
There you go.
And you have to work hard at doing that. And it is a skill. It does. I think it takes more skill to do this than it does to prescribe exercises or to do fucking manual therapy. So it is a fundamental, important thing that therapists have to do. We have to try and win patients over. We have to get them to like us, to trust us. And there are lots of ways of doing that, you know. And one of the simplest ways I tell therapists to start doing that is quite simple. It's just by shutting up, not talking too much, not interrupting people, listening better. That goes a long, long way to developing a relationship. But I think, you know, to answer Michael's question is, what wouldn't I do? Well, I certainly wouldn't start, you know, socializing personally with a patient to try and get them to like me. I wouldn't start, you know, getting a little bit too creepy and crossing the line about, you know, compliments on appearance and things along those lines, because that is pushing the boundaries of professionalism there a bit. So, you know, it comes to maintaining that relationship as being professional and therapeutic rather than starting to go into the personal realms. But I'm also going to say, you know, that I have had, and I still have, friends that used to be patients. I've got people that I've developed a relationship with, you know, over the years that I treated. And I now consider what I call them, friends, perhaps colleagues, but you know, these are people that I would probably quite happy go and have a pint with down the pub and catch up and see how things are going since we last saw each other 4 or 5 years ago. You know, there are people that I've taken through extensive rehabilitation after ACLs and shoulder dislocations and spent months with them. And you say that's, you know, develops a relationship, a knowledge of a person, and that can sometimes then continue on after you've discharged and passed them on. So I'm going to say sometimes those boundaries may be a little bit blurred, but for me, you know, when you're treating somebody, a patient, you've got to maintain the professional line.
Well, I think these things need to be to some degree reciprocal, don't they? So if you have two people that become friendly and outside of a working environment choose to have a drink or whatever, then I think that's between two people, isn't it? You know, at the end of the day. I think, and I have the same. I have, you know, patients that I would regard as friends that are over the years that have been coming to see me for various bits and pieces. They trust me. You know, I'm the first person they call if they hurt their knee or whatever. They trust my opinion and they've taken me to the races or football or we've gone for dinner or drinks or whatever. And, you know, that's what happens.
Or they've done some work in my house because they're a plumber and an electrician as well, which is really useful to have.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Exactly. So, you know, I think where maybe what crosses the line is when these things are not reciprocal. And they only come from one side of the equation. Yeah. And I think that makes things more complicated when one party maybe is approaching the other party in a way that they do not like or they do not wish to happen. And I think that's probably crossing that professional boundary. And I would say that the majority of the people that I have formed close relationships have been the same sex as me, I'll be honest. So I think that it often is probably, you know, not that men and women cannot be friends. I'm going to get in trouble for probably saying that. But I think that blurs the lines a little less potentially.
Yeah, it stops that, you know, accusations and say perhaps, you know, doing it for nefarious reasons rather than just genuine, just wanting to be friendly to somebody. You're not trying to coach or get somebody to become friends for other reasons that may be a little bit, say, nefarious or not quite politically correct. Yeah, that's sure.
Or if you're in a professional environment, you're trying to make it something different. You know, you're in a professional environment, you're being suggestive, or you're, you know, being inappropriate or those type of things, you know. And I think those lines do get more blurred when you have two people of different sexes.
Yeah, they do. And again, you know, I'm going to say sometimes you may find as a therapist, you do get patients misinterpreting
friendly demeanor.
Yeah. So your attempts to build a therapeutic relationship can sometimes be, say, misunderstood, misinterpreted by some people, and that can lead to some awkward, tricky situations. I've had a couple of colleagues who found themselves a little bit in a stickier situation because they perhaps didn't read the signs as quick as they could have done, and sometimes have found that a patient has fallen deeply, madly, head over heels in love with them, when they should have perhaps seen the warning signs a few weeks.
They got like a bunch of flowers or a card. You know,
things like that. People, you know, sending gifts not inappropriately, but just randomly, and it's a bit weird. And then, you know, the little messages in the card are sort of, okay, well, that's pushing it a little.
I love you.
Yeah. And then you get the emails and the text messages and the Facebook requests and stuff like that. So, yeah, I think sometimes with some people, you know, it can be hard to differentiate, you know, somebody just generally being caring, empathetic, and those sometimes, I say, misunderstood. So you do have to sometimes keep your wits about you as a therapist. In fact, all the times with the therapist, you have to be sure that, you know, you're making sure that patients aren't not misunderstanding what you are trying to achieve here.
Yeah, which can be tough. And then we have one last one from Andrew Kyle, who is a regular contributor to the
and unfortunately trying to rehab himself after rupturing his Achilles tendon as well, Andrew. So all the best. Yeah, he ruptured his Achilles tendon about 6 months ago, or maybe not quite that long ago, but I know he's just out of the boot and up and moving around a bit now, but he's still struggling to get back. So keep on the rehab journey, Andrew. I know you sent me a message a couple of weeks ago saying things were going well, which is good to hear, mate, but all the best with it.
Good luck to Andrew. Yeah, I didn't know that. And his question was, and I haven't got it in front of me, was to do with, have you ever taken some type of sabbatical?
Yeah, I haven't personally, so I haven't had any major breaks. You know, I suppose it depends on what you term as a major break from clinical work. So in 20 years, but, you know, I've had, probably the longest I've had off is a month where I've done a tour down under doing some teaching there. I managed to convince my managers to give me a bit of unpaid leave that I used for a whole month to take off from clinics. So I suppose that's the longest in 20 years that I've had without doing any clinics. But, you know, in the last few years, my clinics are also now only part-time. So is that taking a sabbatical when you reduce from 40 hours down to 20 hours a week? You know, you reduce your clinical workload by 50%. I suppose that could also be considered as a sabbatical. But I don't think so. I think most people would probably say a sabbatical is, you know, 6-12 months away from your profession, your vocation, and you go and do something else. You go and, I don't know, walk around
the world.
Travel the world, yeah. You put on a sarong and go to Bali or something, or you start to climb mountains, or you start poetry or something along those. A journey of self-discovery and learn something else in those 6-12 months.
That sounds scary.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, I've been trying to suppress these things, not find them.
Yeah, I don't want to learn more about me. I know enough about me already.
And in fact, I've never. Yeah, so obviously, I don't do as much clinical stuff as I used to do, and I have no desire to go back to those 7 a.m. till 7 p.m. You know, have a little afternoon break and then back to back with patients. And you know, I don't know if I've got the energy for that anymore. However, I don't think I've had a complete sabbatical where I haven't done, you know, anything to do with the whole kind of, you know, pain world, if you like. And that sounds awesome, doesn't it? 12 months away. Do I still get paid from the BCP?
We'll have to put it through HR, mate. We'll see what they say.
Fine. Yeah, so no, I mean, I think that I don't know if I do like the sounds of that, if I'm being honest. I've never felt like I've needed a sabbatical.
No.
One thing I would
I think I've definitely felt burnout. I've definitely felt the pressures of working, as you say, 7 o'clock in the morning and having to travel in. And, you know, you get a busy day where you've got back-to-back clinics and you've got back-to-back patients. Yeah, and you haven't had time to go to the toilet break.
You've got
20 notes to write at the end of the day. You know, there's all those sort of pressures of the day-to-day job, which I definitely have thought, bugger this, I need a break from this. I need something to change, otherwise it is going to burn me out, and it has almost burned me out. But no, I'm like you. I don't think I ever have felt the need that I want to stop reading about the profession, about the area. I don't think I've ever felt the need to stop, you know, teaching or talking about it or helping people. You know, I still feel that as a part of me would feel missing if I didn't do anything at all to do with the profession for an extended period of time. I don't think my brain or my personality would allow it.
No. So what I will say, and I think this is useful for everybody, you know, me and Adam are, we're no spring chickens, are we anymore? You know,
speak for yourself.
Well, we're both in later.
I'm only 33.
We're both over 40, let's say.
So some of us are over 50.
Well, yeah, and that's not me. So what I think is really beneficial for people's careers is variety, whether that's doing some clinical stuff, whether it's doing some teaching, whether it's doing management, whether it's doing all three of them, because what I think that stops is that kind of day-to-day burnout monotony. And so I think, you know, I for many, many years used to travel into central London on that first bloody train, you know, from Lewisham Station all the way into Bond Street, and, you know, spend all day, come home in the rush hour again, you know. And I think that pushed me to the edge. But when I think you have a bit more variety, I think you probably, you know, whether that's a bit of working from home, bit of clinic, bit of traveling and teaching, I think that definitely helps offset some of that. Because I think burnout sometimes comes from monotony. And one of the things that frustrates me quite a lot is when people say, oh, my God, you're not a full-time clinician anymore and this type of stuff. And I just think to myself, well, is that where everyone needs to start their journey and finish their journey? You know, I think we should all be open to having our own career path that stimulates us as individuals. And, you know,
I think that
should be your choice.
Yeah, I don't think many clinicians are going to be still continually seeing the volume of patients that they were at the beginning of the career, they will be at their end of the career. No way.
No,
I don't think they need to be, because the skills and the experience that a clinician gets, the more they help and see patients, the better off they will be helping the next generation of clinicians coming through. So their time should be directed not just to helping patients, but also to helping other clinicians as well, and doing other things. So again, I think it's a bit selfish if an experienced clinician isn't doing some other stuff where they're educating and treating and teaching and doing things as well.
Yeah, I just, you know, it's the stick that people use to try and have a pop at people, isn't it, of course?
But that's just jealous individuals, mate, probably of saying not happy that the fact that you're doing things that they wish they were doing. There's always those dickheads in the world.
Yes, yes. And they will remain nameless for now. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think we should all, you know, you should take the journey that makes you happy and that looks like the thing that you want it to look like. And if other people get annoyed and upset at that, well, then that's their problem, not your problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I say, make sure that you don't get yourself burnt out, as Ben said, with the monotony of the day-to-day grind as well. And I also think another thing that's really useful for helping prevent burnout is having some autonomy over your clinics, having some sort of control.
Yeah. Or your life and career in general.
Absolutely. I think the more, as I say, variety and the more autonomy you tend to have, the better clinician you will tend to be.
Good, good, good. Well, another Thoughtful Thursday in the bag.
Done and dusted. They do go quickly these months, don't they? Yesterday that we were doing this before, so I can't believe another month has come back already.
Exactly. Well, Easter is in the pipeline. I'm going to try and have a few days off. Are you going to have a few days off?
I am, mate. I'm going to try and switch off for a bit and enjoy the Easter break, get some nice spring lamb down my neck and maybe even a bottle of red wine with it.
Good man. Couple of Easter eggs, or will that mess up your HRV?
I'm not one for Easter eggs, if I'm being. I don't mind a bit of chocolate, but it has to be dark chocolate. I'm not a fan of all this milk chocolate sort of Easter egg stuff.
Do they not do like a grenade Easter egg?
I'll be surprised if they didn't. I'll be surprised if the protein companies haven't. What a great idea. I might look into one of those.
Yeah, I'll always catch Adam with it with a bit of protein. That's his snack.
That's it. All right, people. Well, again, thanks to the BCPers for asking the questions, as always. And if you are listening to this on the podcast and you're not a BCP member, as always, you know, you are more than welcome to come and join the community. No contracts, no commitment. Come and go as much as you like. 4 years worth of clinical content and gold on there. Over 400 videos of various different things on various different topics and subjects, and lots of special expert guest interviews as well. All that just for £12. You'd be crazy not to actually sign up and get a little taster, just a little view of what it looks like to become a Better Clinician Project member, a BCP member. And say, if you don't like it and you think it's all a load of crap, which we don't think you will do, you're more than welcome to go away the next month.
There you go.
Right. All right. So to everybody else, until next month, take care of yourselves and each other, and happy Easter.
See you later. Thank you for listening to the BCP podcast. If you would like to check out the BCP, please go to www.betterclinicianproject.com. There we have literally hundreds of videos on clinical topics, exercise examples for rehabilitation, and research reviews, alongside features such as Thoughtful Thursday. And please tune in again.